Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
It was exciting to hear that we'd had 1,000.
Amazing, I think.
Yeah, considering this was started just like as a little hobby between us, and I think we've come a long way from, I just remember when we put up that first conversation between you and I about what was going to happen, what we were doing with the podcast, and my utter cringiness and really wanting to take it down straight away. But also, you know, I'm actually really grateful to you for doing this project with me, and I wanted to thank you for that, because had that been me, I'd have felt like, oh, I just want to stop at this point. I wouldn't have continued further. And now I'm actually really, really enjoying it. And, you know, when I listen to the conversations back each time, I enjoy them as much afterwards as when we're actually having the conversation.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's worked out very well. I didn't have the same urge to take it down as you did, because I've done so many embarrassing things in my life, which certainly my children have always been quite keen to draw attention to, that doing another one was no problem at all. And since then we've gone on and we've met some really interesting people. It's been quite extraordinary that people I've really wondered, what are we going to talk to them about, have brought out ideas and information and techniques that have really surprised me.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, you know, everyone who's been on has been so lovely, and each been very passionate about quite often quite different subject areas, and several people whose work probably isn't even all that well known, and yet actually they've got something really valuable to say. And I think, you know, our starting point, I think, was about wanting to try and learn more about, you know, wanting to do something about things that are nourishing and uplifting. And certainly for me, I know that I find learning really nourishing and needed some kind of like counterbalance to the last 12 months. And actually doing this has really enabled that through getting to have all these really interesting conversations with people that have sparked new ideas. And each one, I think, we're left with, oh, let's go. We need to go and find somebody that can talk more on a tangential theme, which probably wasn't even on our radar before then.
Yeah, I think we began with the idea that we would focus on resilience and creativity, and we would look at those institutions that had been going for some years and continue. So we'd be thinking about what are the features of those places that give them the power and the dynamic to continue, and what are the things that live on in those institutions that have stopped but continue to have a life of their own. For example, the Henderson Hospital, it must be probably 15 or 16 years. 15 years since it closed down. They've still got a very active group of service users and staff who stick together and do things together. So if we think about where we began with Gareth and Lucy telling us about their research at Gartree Prison, as it happens, comparing what might loosely be called therapeutic wings with the ordinary mainstream wings. And I thought that was a really interesting place to start, because it was, as it were, a kind of benchmark. It was thinking about, does anything make a difference? Is A different to B? And if so, what is it? And I thought it was really refreshing to hear that such a relatively simple piece of research could illustrate that quite simple differences in the behaviour and the staffing level could make a huge difference.
Yeah, I agree. And that emphasis upon how important atmosphere is, which actually we've returned to later as well, because Abdullah's reflections on the importance of having consistent staff and also having staff within a service that kind of serve as, metaphorically serve as parents to the to service, and how important that is in order to create a sense of safety and containment. And you can see that in a therapeutic service, it's easier to have that sense of parental figures and good parental figures, which might have been what Gareth and Lucy's research was picking up on.
Yeah. And you mentioned Abdullah, and he was a terrific person to talk to, I think. And he made a number of comments which really brought me up sharp, I suppose. For example, he was describing how wherever he is, he's always on his guard. So there's always a large part of him, a larger part than most of us, it sounded like, who's having to watch what he says and how he says it, and to be concerned about how other people, even people he's worked with very closely for some time, how they might be interpreting things. And I thought that was a really powerful insight to the, you know, the struggles of a Muslim man working anywhere, I think, in our country.
Absolutely. I mean, if you remember as well, in his, there was an anecdote about one of the prisoners who wanted to convert to Islam, and his, the sense of burden that what would it be like to have a head of psychology who was a Muslim man within the service, and whether there would be a sense that I suppose I took from that a fear that he would be seen as influencing prisoners within the services. You know, it's a hard job to do anyway without having that additional burden placed on you, I think.
Yeah.
I think also we've heard kind of like from, you know, from three people with lived experience in Liz Mullinar, Michaela Booth and Morgan Godwin about the importance of learning from those with lived experience. And particularly, I suppose, what I've took from those conversations was how important it was to, in terms of the language we use, and how vital that is to get that right, because actually we may well intend to be inclusive, but our language might easily serve as barriers and obstructions to participation and to enabling people to move on in a way that's healthy and allows them to grow. And, you know, if we don't want them to hold on to an identity as an offender, why would we call them an offender? You know, why not enable people to think more about that just being a part of who they've been, rather than make it something that's also entirely wedded to their future?
Yeah, it was interesting how all three of them had gone on and used their experience in such a creative and dynamic way. Michaela, of course, doing her work inside prisons, as well as doing, I think, quite a lot of teaching, and she's got tremendous energy, so she's continuing her own research. And Morgan, of course, has linked up with the political stream in the state of Oregon, and has become a drugs advisor to the state there. Liz Mullinar was interesting because she was quite different, really. Obviously, she was full of energy and full of conviction, really, about what she did. And I was impressed by the kind of sheer amount of hope that she brought to her work. But it came with a kind of insistence that people had to want to change and want to develop. And then she and her colleagues and all the other participants will be able to join in and create this very powerful dynamic of helping people to change.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that sense of hope in Liz as well. And I suppose, again, with Michaela, what was really striking was that sense of someone who had believed in Michaela's ability to do something different, to be a positive force in the world. And I suppose what that really underlines for me is how important it is for staff to go to work in a positive mood and to care about the people they're working with. Because actually, how do you get that sense that you are somebody who can do something, who can achieve, if you're only being met with staff who are cynical or feeling a bit negative? So, you know, it's absolutely invaluable and so important that staff are going into work feeling nourished and in a healthy place themselves, else they won't be able to communicate that to the people they're working with.
And I think she also insisted upon the capacity and the space to be authentic, so that those with lived experiences who were going to be taking that into their places of work had to be allowed to do that honestly and openly, not seeking to gain support and recognition from those around them. That should be given. That should be a given.
Yeah, and again, that theme of authenticity has cropped up across multiple interviews, hasn't it? If you remember, Abdullah also talking a lot about authenticity, and also Richard Shuker and Jerry Akerman talking about how Grendon nurtures that sense of people being able to live their authentic selves. I think it has been interesting, that sense of care, and that even in Grendon, which I think is probably streets ahead of many other places in terms of people being able to talk openly and honestly about feelings. And it was interesting that there was that kind of like balking at the notion, you know, in healthcare we talk about loving compassion and the concept of agape, and how easy it can be to talk about that in health settings at times, but how fearful people are of talking about that in prisons. And even though Jerry and Richard were talking about prisoners talking about having loved the officer who was leaving, there was still a sense of that being a taboo subject to express care in a positive way. And yet we know ourselves that anger gets expressed very readily within the prison system.
Well, there's this terrible fear of conditioning, isn't there, in the prison service. Is one of those things that gets drummed into staff continually. Richard and Geraldine, of course, here represented Grendon, and Grendon has cropped up several times through our conversations. He cropped up a lot when we were talking to David Wilson and Michael Brooks. They, of course, had just produced a very interesting paper about Barlini. And what I took from that was that they weren't dismissive of research, but they certainly seemed to think that managing the social and political climate was probably as important as research. In other words, you could produce as much research as you liked, but if the political atmosphere was hostile, then you might come to a sticky end. And Michael told us how hard he'd had to work whilst he worked at Grendon in managing that culture.
Yeah, I thought they used an interesting expression, didn't they? I'm not sure. I think maybe it was David that used the expression of you can't grow too tall as a poppy, and the idea that either the prisoners or the service kind of like have to know their place, and if you get too big for your boots, that you'll get struck down. And I suppose it does make me think whether, you know, having prisons and prisoners, perhaps more so than psychiatric patients, but certainly it seems to serve a function for society to have people who can be looked down on and make other people feel better. Obviously, I'm not saying that's right, but there is that sense of not allowing the possibility that actually very many people could, if turned out that way, could find themselves, unfortunate enough to be in those kind of circumstances. Lorna Rhodes made an interesting point when we interviewed her, didn't she? Because I really loved Lorna's storytelling way of recounting something, which actually she shares in common with Andrew Jefferson. So maybe that's something about prison ethnography, that, you know, that's how they communicate. It's that attention to detail. But what I enjoyed Lorna's anecdote about Mr. Larson and how unorthodox he was. And I suppose that's a flavour of the interviews that we've had. If many of the people that we've interviewed are not kind of like mainstream voices for people working in harsh settings or forensic environments, then you don't hear them platformed in many places. And yet I think we've heard something really interesting from each person that we've interviewed. But there is something, I think, about unorthodox characters perhaps bringing new ways of looking at things, and also not needing to assimilate to what everybody else does in the system, and that allows for the possibility of some kind of like real change with exciting and different things that might bring progress.
Yeah, what I remember from Lorna was her describing her experience at Grendon of going into a meeting with about 40 men, and sitting down on what she described as benches, and what I would think of as being seats, and rubbing shoulders on either sides with the residents there. And she thought this was an extraordinary experience, and she did it, of course, for a month or more every day. So she really got a good flavour of that. Are you thinking about Gwen Adshead? We had a lovely conversation with Gwen Adshead, and I thought Gwen gave a lovely description of collegiate working with some of her colleagues, originally at St George's, I think it was, and then at Broadmoor, many of the same people. And she mentioned Murray Cox, who had clearly been a big influence on her. And then she described this change that she made from thinking of herself as a psychiatrist to thinking of herself as a psychotherapist, and how that brought her the ability to just sit down and think about things with people, meeting with them rather than managing or administering, which is, I think, how she saw psychiatrists as operating. Although interestingly enough, she also thought that psychiatrists had lost a lot of that power. Is power what she meant? In managing a team. So she seems to think that some of that had drained away from the position of being a psychiatrist, which I think linked up with the themes of a number of other people. So it's certainly been an issue in Grendon, who held the power, and I'm sure it was an issue down at Wormwood Scrubs as well, who had the power, who made the decisions, particularly about what kind of treatment regime was going to be used. And in particular, what cropped up several times, I think, was, do we have a model which is fairly adaptable, or do we have a rigid psychoanalytic model? And of course, coming from a sort of psychoanalytic background, I find this quite a painful argument to listen to. But I certainly know there's a lot in it. I know that a lot of psychoanalytic psychotherapists, psychoanalysts, were also doctors, and they also had insisted on having the last word. So it was interesting hearing that beginning to come into our general discourse.
Yeah, it was. But I suppose I also took the fact that she really embraced that role because she wanted to relate to people in a meaningful, connected way. And I think that was also, you know, we've heard that from other people about, you know, Gareth and Lucy, when they were talking about the therapeutic services, that actually allows relating in a meaningful and connected way, and Abdullah's reflections on his service, and then, you know, Michaela talking about how important it was to be on the receiving end of that meaningful connection. So I think that's something that is a common theme across the board. And just thinking back to when we, you know, when we started, so we I think we had half of the, you know, maybe most of the picture was about things about what helps people survive, and how do people preserve their wholesomeness, and how do you prevent yourself from being traumatized, and how to affect compassionate culture change. But I suppose there was also the question of what happens when people aren't able to protect themselves from that. And I don't think we've really explored that. And I think the closest we got to that at all was interviewing Andrew Jefferson about the really challenging work that he does for Dignity, Danish Institute for the Prevention of Torture, and some of the dreadful circumstances he must have gone into and seen. And, you know, Andrew isn't somebody who presents that as I mean, certainly you can hear his passion about his work and his fascination with that. So he's not someone who sees himself as being victimised by that. But I suppose I'm aware that we haven't really dug into the kind of like the darker side of what's challenging about the environments. We've focused a lot on what's helpful and how to try and be in a more positive place and keep yourself nourished. But probably for us, there's a bit of a challenge of also looking at some of the less, you know, the more unsavoury elements of the work when people haven't been able to protect themselves.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Is that a good place to stop?
Yep.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com, and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.